Hello, welcome to The Lancet Voice. It's February 2023. I'm Gavin Cleaver and we're very happy to have you with us. We're focusing at the moment on child and adolescent health as part of our spotlights on particular areas for this, our 200th year. You can find out more about these spotlights and about our goals for our 200th anniversary year at thelancet.com/lancet-200. For today's episode, I'm very pleased to be joined by the Acting Editor-in-Chief of The Lancet Healthy Longevity, Philippa Harris. You'll hear Philippa speaking with two guests today about Indigenous child and adolescent health. Welcome, Philippa. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came up with this particular topic and why it's so important?
The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health Spotlight has two asks. And one is that we stop thinking about children as a kind of future resource and we actually focus on their needs now. But the other ask is that we really focus on the health inequalities that you see between different groups of children, both within specific countries and also globally. And Indigenous children and adolescents, regardless of where in the world they live, have poorer health outcomes compared to the general population. And so we thought this was a really important topic and a great one to dive into in a bit more detail.
Yeah. And why don't you tell us how you came across the first interviewee, who is Lisa Richardson?
I think Lisa's someone that has worked with Jessamy before, and she's a really cool voice in this, in the area of Indigenous health, and has done lots of great work in terms of medical education and with the University of Toronto. And I just thought she'd be such a great person to hear speak.
And the other chat as well is really interesting. It's Eve Minani, who's talking about the one of the tribes in Burundi and the children and adolescent health in that tribe in particular. How did that come to your attention?
The Batwa communities. Yeah, Eve is an activist and I knew of him through his work that he's done with the United Nations. And I just thought it would be really interesting to hear a voice from a country where we don't necessarily hear so much about Indigenous communities. I think Indigenous communities in Africa often are overlooked in the conversations.
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting. Well, they're two really great interviews that you're about to hear right now.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks so much for joining us on this podcast. You know, we're delighted you're here. Could you start just by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So my name is Dr. Lisa Richardson. I practice general internal medicine in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. My background is mixed Anishinaabe and my community is called Shebanoning, which is in northeastern Ontario, about 3.5 hours north of Toronto. It's also known as Killarney. And my work is primarily in both clinical practice in internal medicine and also strategic work in education in Indigenous health.
So one of the things that, you know, the Lancet is very interested in is reducing inequities in healthcare, especially in children and adolescents. And I was wondering if you wanted to start just by talking about, you know, Indigenous children and adolescents and whether they experience equitable healthcare.
Big sigh. Because this has been, of course, a focus of for many countries is trying to close the health gaps for Indigenous peoples. And the short answer is that Indigenous children and youth do experience health inequities. So there are significant gaps, and they actually cross a range of areas. So chronic illnesses such as diabetes, the results of infectious illnesses such as rheumatic heart disease are both much higher among Indigenous youth. There is data not only in Canada and the US, but also in Australia in those areas. Low birth weight as well as high birth weight is higher among Indigenous people. And there's, again, data across across the globe for Indigenous peoples that demonstrates that. Mental illness and suicide are higher among Indigenous peoples. So you're getting a sense, Philippa, of the range of areas, not just physical health, but mental health. And I would say by proxy, emotional health are all areas of concern and gaps for Indigenous peoples and very much connected, which I'm sure we'll talk further about, to social determinants of health.
So I'm interested, you were saying that, you know, this is an area that some, well, hopefully all governments are looking at as a sort of something that they want to change. Have you seen progress, do you think?
What I'm seeing are really, really amazing commitments to community-based interventions. Data in specific areas, for example, specific regions or in specific communities are demonstrating progress. We haven't yet seen huge sort of systematic reviews that are demonstrating, you know, changes and improvements in ear health across the board for Indigenous youth. But we are seeing programs that are working. And I think those interventions and examples of that community-based work are what we need to focus on.
What are the barriers to equitable care? You know, why are we seeing these big differences?
Yeah, I think as is well known by Indigenous peoples in many different countries and jurisdictions, the most significant determinant of health for Indigenous peoples across the globe is definitely colonization and its subsequent effects. Let's take some of the illnesses that I spoke about, diabetes, and the fact that, for example, in Canada, Indigenous First Nations youth on reserve have much, much higher rates of youth onset type 2 diabetes than the rest of the population. Type 2 diabetes is related to food security. It's related to obesity. And if we think about those two areas, both of those examples are disruptions that were caused by colonization. So by moving people into a reserve system where they no longer have access to traditional territory, where ways of being and living in a daily basis, such as hunting and gathering foods, are no longer not even possible due to a land base, but early in the courses of colonial regimes here, or governments, they were actually banned. And so you're no longer able to be active in the same way, no longer able to have access to healthy food. So there's a preponderance of more processed food. So that's one example of, with a particular condition of diabetes, of how colonialism and its downstream effects, including food security and land-based activities, lack of ability to practice the usual land-based activity, has really caused a health gap. So what does that mean? The interventions actually need to not just target diagnosis and treatment of the specific illness, but all of those upstream factors.
So yeah, I was going to ask what you think are the best ways to overcome these barriers. And you know, I can see that it's not a nice, easy answer, like, oh, just do this one thing. What do you think are the best ways that we can address those issues?
Yeah, it always becomes a bit, it can seem a bit overwhelming. In Canada, our distinct communities, our First Nations, Inuit and Métis, it can seem overwhelming when we say, okay, tuberculosis rates, for example, are very high amongst Inuit here, both youth and adults. How do we address that? Well, you need to take a comprehensive approach to any specific illness, which is what is happening right now. And it's being led by the Inuit organization ITK here in Canada. They've hired someone specifically to help look at, okay, well, what do we need to do about housing? How can we address close quarters and inadequate housing and overcrowding? How can we address ventilation? How can we then address early diagnosis and making sure that the person who is diagnosed is actually able to be cared for away from others? So, and by the way, I do not mean removed to the south, which is what typically used to happen for Inuit, where they would be come from the north to southern sanatoriums and be disconnected from community. I just mean where they're no longer, you know, they're able to be convalescing and be cared for in a comprehensive way with comfort. I think that we need to, you know, so you need those comprehensive approaches. But what's most important, Philippa, is the approaches need to be guided by communities and Indigenous health professionals. So understanding what is needed specifically, for example, if one community has a high rate of suicide, what are the life-affirming approaches that can be adopted? So I've seen in the northwest of Ontario, amazing land-based programs where youth are taken out with elders and with others and go to the goose camp and learn how to hunt. And in so doing, also learned all about traditional knowledge, connection to the land, hear from elders, speak the language. So all of those activities that bring a strong sense of identity, pride in self, pride in community, then have these amazing benefits for mental health and wellness. So I think, I hope that's specific enough. So the idea is that we do need to have targeted and distinct approaches not only for Indigenous peoples, but even more distinct within communities and within nations, so that are community specific, that share general principles, but that are also guided by the leaders in those communities and by Indigenous health professionals who understand and can work with communities in trusting and thoughtful ways.
And do you think the communities, I mean, I appreciate you'll be talking sort of from a North American perspective, but do you think that communities have the power, you know, do the systems allow the communities to really drive the change? I mean, I can see how these interventions will never work unless they're community led, like you said, but, you know, you're talking about, you know, systems that have kind of oppressed Indigenous people for ages. Do you feel the systems are changing? Do you feel like the communities, you know, now have the power?
I do. I mean, Indigenous peoples across the globe have their rights protected by the UN Declaration on the Rights for Indigenous Peoples, which upholds the right to self-determination. You know, one of the amazing places where really cool community-based initiatives are happening are both in New Zealand and Australia. So, for example, to target the high rates of rheumatic fever, which lead to rheumatic heart disease, which is a preventable infection with an antibiotic, I met an amazing young Maori doctor who was working in her own community, actually on a program to train community health professionals. And there's a similar program that's been written about in Northern Australia. So I think governments are understanding that they need to actually uphold these rights, which means in many cases, a transfer of responsibility for healthcare or co-management of healthcare prior to the transfer. And I think so we are moving that way. There are numerous examples, even looking at some of the changes in the land back movement across the globe are really, really important.
And I wonder if we could just sort of backtrack, because you were talking obviously about, you know, mental health of Indigenous youth being an area of particular inequities. And I wanted to talk about, you know, the last couple of years. Do you think COVID-19 has had a big impact on that? And what has that impact been?
As we know, COVID, not only from the literature, but from those of us who are parents or guardians or aunties, uncles, we've seen the effects of this pandemic on the mental health and well-being of our youth, and not just Indigenous youth. And so absolutely, this has strained that. But I think what is remarkable is how Indigenous youth have responded to COVID. It's an example of resilience and the importance of culture. The desire to care for and protect elders in community, the engagement in activities like food delivery and, you know, FaceTiming or regularly with elders is something that's been talked about here and written about as well by Indigenous youth. The desire to actually share what they're doing related to public health practices through TikTok and all their social media has been a really cool example of how youth have actually, I think, demonstrated resilience despite the isolation. Absolutely, it has been an issue. And we have had communities in Canada where there have been particularly bad outcomes related to mental health. But what has been amazing is then to see the community response, not just within community, but surrounding communities to actually help and intervene. I think the other piece to note is that because of the move to online learning has also created significant inequities for Indigenous peoples and you know, particularly for schooling, because there is not always the same infrastructure for online school. And there are examples of places here where youth actually just were not able to engage in the online school, that they had to pick up textbooks and learn independently and then do check-ins because they didn't have the Wi-Fi access on their reserve.
That's something we certainly saw in the UK as well. I mean, not specifically with Indigenous youth, but people that didn't have the technology really, really suffered. And it's something that I think certainly in the UK, I don't think enough has been done to try and sort of address that gap and catch up. I don't know if there's been any efforts in the Toronto area or wider where you've seen efforts to try and bridge that gap.
I think the major piece here is that we need to see the infrastructure commitment, and some governments have made that commitment. It just will take a while to do that. In terms of the gaps that will emerge with respect to education, I haven't necessarily seen a cohesive strategy yet. And I think it is a real problem. Why this is relevant to health, of course, when we're talking about youth and children and adolescents, school is a huge component of, and education is a big part of future health. There are also tons of opportunities that I like to think about in terms of community-based healthcare within schools. I mean, I grew up in the era of a school nurse. And what an incredible opportunity to have touch points with you and to level the access and care issue, which often occurs, hearing screening, eye screening, et cetera. We used to have all of those exams. So schools as a touch point for community health, for vaccine strategies, et cetera. I think that's very important. But schools are also a virtual infrastructure or digital infrastructure is really important to health because of all the virtual care that's exploded during COVID. And so if we don't have that infrastructure, then actually those gaps, and we haven't talked at all about access, particularly for those in remote communities or in areas where they're not close to, they don't have easy access to hospitals and clinics and have care delivered by nursing stations, that digital health is a really important component that we need to be attentive to as we try to ramp it up.
Yeah, it certainly seemed to me that there's sort of such tremendous opportunities there if the infrastructure was in place and, you know, communities that do suffer because of rural locations. There's so much going on now that could really kind of make a difference if they can tap into it. I know medical education is an area that you're very passionate about and you've done a lot of work in. Talking about kind of representation with healthcare practitioners, how important is it for children and adolescents to see themselves represented in the healthcare practitioners they're interacting with?
It's hugely important. I mean, the literature around this, Philippa, is primarily from the US when we look at that I'm familiar with, particularly amongst Black youth and Black patients and their providers, demonstrating how cultural congruence, so being of the same background as your provider, actually leads to better health outcomes. Not really surprising, right? You can relate to the person, you see yourself, but also other more granular factors like more time being listened to, opportunity to ask more questions. It's actually fascinating. We see this anecdotally in terms of how Indigenous youth respond and are inspired by Indigenous care practitioners. And the ability to connect with your practitioner, particularly as an adolescent, I think, is so important. So it is key, not only for the actual care received by Indigenous children, but actually to strive and aspire to consider a career in healthcare and to be able to give back to your community if that's what you choose to do. The literature also shows that those from underrepresented groups in medicine are more likely to care for underrepresented populations. So it's yet another reason why this is so important. I think the other piece about Indigenous care providers is not just understanding the specific context, the barriers that may be faced by an Indigenous client who they're seeing, but also bringing that breadth of knowledge from an Anishinaabe perspective for, you know, mental, physical, emotional well-being and spiritual well-being, the four directions of care, which are typically not addressed in the usual biomedical system. It's just, mental health and physical health. And by the way, they're quite separate. They're not seen as intertwined very often, although they should be. So considering those cultural dimensions of care, the spiritual dimensions of a person's well-being, which are so, and emotional health, which is about connection to family, connection to community, connection to your land base. So how Indigenous providers can bring that multidimensional perspective into the care they provide is amazing, not just for Indigenous youth, but for, I would argue, for all people who are seeking healthcare.
Now, I find that really interesting, the kind of the much more holistic view of kind of health and well-being that seems to come out. And it seems like something that's really not captured very well in the medical literature. Is that something you think is changing as we see more research led by Indigenous peoples? You know, do you think the kind of that more holistic view is coming out more.
Absolutely. I think the line there that is critical is research that is being led by Indigenous peoples. And often now with the most relevant and important research on Indigenous health, there are knowledge keepers present, there are community members present, there as well as Indigenous researchers. I don't want to give the impression, though, from our conversation, that there is no role for non-Indigenous providers. Absolutely not. There is a huge role that non-Indigenous providers can play and need to play. We don't have nearly enough Indigenous providers, and strong allyship and learning to understand your local community and the context where you work and building relationships with the leaders, with the families, with the children is so critical. And I've seen amazing examples of non-Indigenous researchers and providers who've done incredible work in Indigenous communities. So I don't want to suggest that this can only be done by Indigenous peoples, but the key is it must be led by Indigenous peoples, and that it must be conceptualized by. The heavy lifting doesn't all need to be done by the Indigenous care providers. In fact, we're seeing a lot of burnout among Indigenous providers because there's so much strain and so much, the expectations are so high, or the workload is so high. So it really has to be a shared initiative.
And talking about increasing participation for kind of future generations, what cultural shifts would you like to see to encourage more Indigenous youth to consider or access careers in healthcare and be that next generation of leaders?
We need to have dedicated access programs into the health professions. But here's the caveat. The programs should not just be at the undergrad level, because, of course, some of the programs that I'm talking about, medicine specifically is in Canada anyway, it's a post-sec. You have to have an undergraduate degree first. I know in the UK it's different, but we need to go back not just into high schools, we need to go into elementary schools. We need Indigenous youths and children to actually see role models who are Indigenous and have summer mentorship programs and summer camps and exposure to science and understand the beauty and fun and creativity of science, let alone melding that with Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous science. It's exciting. And so those programs need to actually extend back. And so that's what we have been doing at the University of Toronto. We realized, okay, we've got a great high school mentorship program where students get a credit. And our data shows that many of the youth who participate in that 1 month program, and then there's a longitudinal follow up over the years, actually go on into careers in the healthcare professions. And that's for both Black and Indigenous youth. We have developed a separate program that is for even younger people, for children in early high school and in late elementary school. And my goal is to actually go even further back and have like a cool summer camp for grades kids in primary school. So I think those are the sorts of things that we need to be doing to encourage folks in these exciting careers.
No, that sounds fantastic. And I have young kids, and it's amazing how even really young kids respond so positively to kind of science and health, and they find it so fun. And it, yeah, I think if you can tap into that early, it's great. So thank you so much for joining us, Ayuza. You know, we're delighted you're here to speak to us. Could you start just by telling us a bit about yourself, and then we'll get the conversation started.
Okay. Eva Minani, founder and executive director of Indigenous organization called Inyo de Peuple Autochtone pour le Réveil au Développement. Also, I am regional coordinator of Indigenous network called Initiative for Equality. We cover the country Burundi, DRC, and Rwanda. Also, I am Africa regional focal point of Indigenous Youth Global Indigenous Youth Caucus.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So we're talking about health inequities and healthcare for Indigenous children and adolescents. So I was wondering if you could just start by talking about, you know, your experience of inequities and, you know, whether you think Indigenous children and adolescents experience equitable healthcare.
Before talking about healthcare of Indigenous children and adolescents, let's tell you in small words about my community. In my country, Burundi, Batwa estimate about 100 people, so around 1% of the national people. It's difficult to find exactly the statistic of Batwa in Burundi because investigation of some group is not allowed. So Batwa dispersed everywhere in small communities, often at the periphery of mixed areas. They live in a discrimination, extreme poverty, lack of access to health service, lack of means and the lack of land. So laid off sharp and the quick decrease of this community. About the equitable health care, it's difficult to get good health for adolescents and the youth because of malnourishment. So they don't have access to insurance health care because of lack of means. Yeah, that I can say about equitable health care of adolescent and the youth in general.
And you talk about the difficulties the community face. What do you think the main reasons for these difficulties are?
So the main reasons of this difficult, in our country we have two ethnic. In Burundi, to get a job, our constitution refer to the ethnicism. So they say that 50% of Hutu and 50% of Tutsi to get a job, also to get any opportunity. It mentioned in the constitution. So for Batwa to get a job, to get any opportunity in Burundi is very difficult because nowhere is mentioned the opportunity for the Batwa.
And do you see any appetite for change? You know, do you think the government is doing enough to try and improve the situation for the Batwa?
Yeah. Actually, we see even we don't have any place in the constitution. There is some advantage for us because in this period, the Batwa are integrated in some areas. For example, from 2020, we have a minister and some staff in the government. In French, they said cooptation. They don't have access to some services. They try to add to integrate Batwa in some areas.
And how do you think the best way to overcome these barriers are? And are there any initiatives you're aware of that have helped?
We continue the advocacy for us, for example, to integrate in everywhere the Batwa. About health, for example, nowadays Batwa live in misery, in poverty. We see many Batwa are dying by hunger because of lack of land. But we are trying to convince the government to give land to Batwa. It's one of the solution to overcome that problem because we can't live without eating. We can't live. We can't get access to good health without eating.
One thing that really unites Indigenous communities across the world is this right to land and right to exist in the way they used to. I wondered, just talking about, you know, food security and land, if you wanted to talk about climate change and whether you're seeing that having an impact.
Yeah, about climate change, also we get many problems about that. For example, before we are the owner of the forest, of everything, and we safeguard our forest. But today, no Batwa are the forest because of protect the our forest are become the protected area, and some Batwas lived in the mountain. where they can't get easily water and everything to feed our families. So, for example, when the rain come, it's difficult to resist on that. If there is any climate change, it's very difficult to resist because we live in the mountain where we can't get anything.
You talked that there's been a bit of progress recently. Sort of government is starting to perhaps integrate the Batwa communities into their initiatives and things. Does it feel on the ground like progress is being made?
What we do that progress is not enough. It's not enough because there are some. So we are trying to convince the government to give the land to the Batwa, also to elaborate some specific policies of Batwa, because we don't have a specific policy of Batwa. For example, today this actual president he understands the problem of Batwa, but the future president he could say that no, I forget about Batwa. Reason why we continue our advocacy to be mentioned in constitution, also some specific laws which could protect us.
Obviously, you're working for an organization that's really involved in this group. Have you been able to work kind of across country with other organizations working with Batwa communities to work yeah. together, or has that been a challenge?
Yeah, for example, today we are working with the other indigenous organization in Rwanda, also in Congo. Sometimes we make advocates together in order to convince our governments, because even Burundi, even Rwanda, in general in East Africa, we live the same situation. Reason why we are trying to put our force together with other organizations in different countries.
Looking to the future, if you could make one change to improve the health of Indigenous children and adolescents, would it be to have recognition in the constitution, or is there, if you can sort of, if you had a magic wand and you could make one change?
Is the, when we see when you see the, our future, we don't see where we go, because it is if it's very difficult to change the constitution. So it's very, very difficult to see our future, but we continue the advocacy. Perhaps it will go well, but what we see is very, very difficult to change the constitution. Only they give us some opportunities. That opportunities we are trying to convince the government to elaborate the specific policies and the laws which could protect us. If not, we don't see, if they don't elaborate or write those policies, those opportunities, the constitution or everywhere, we don't see the future of our youth. What I want to talk about also is about women. So with Amplify for Change, we are trying to help our Batwa women to, because there are some violence against women, for example rape. So we are trying to work hard with that issue, because it's very, 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 we have many cases about rape. Yeah, is what I could add.
So women's rights are sort of a big area of advocacy work for you at the moment.
Yeah. So I thank you very much for this time you give me to tell you about children and adolescents in my country, also about her in my country.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of The Lancet Voice. This podcast will be marking The Lancet's 200th anniversary throughout 2023 by focusing on the spotlights with lots of different guest hosts from across The Lancet Group. Remember to subscribe if you haven't already, and we'll see you back here soon. Thanks so much for listening.